Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on a former Portage Union leader sentenced to more than 42 months in prison for his role in an assault on a group of non-union iron workers. Governor Eric Holcomb announced Wednesday he's giving the green light to move to Phase 5 of his Back on Track plan. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Legacy Foundation President Carolyn Saxton. The Legacy Foundation and the Indiana Black Expo are offering COVID-19 relief grants to small business owners in Gary and East Chicago. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Janae Urbanbach, the general manager of Majestic Star Casinos in Gary, has been named chairwoman and chief executive officer of parent company Spectacle Entertainment and Spectacle Gary. Spectacle said Urbanbach is the first woman in Indiana gaming to serve in that position. The company also said Urbanbach is the first female to be named chair of a casino company's board of directors in the U.S. When asked about the new chapter for Spectacle Entertainment, Urbanbach said she's excited about her new chapter for Spectacle Entertainment, which is in the midst of construction of the new Hard Rock Casino to be located at Interstate 8094 and the Burr Street Interchange. Chief Executive Officer Urbanbach will continue overseeing the day-to-day operations at Majestic Star Casinos until operations begin at the new Hard Rock Casino in early 2021. As part of her new roles, Urbanbach will represent Spectacle Entertainment in its partnership with Hard Rock and will play an intricate role in building and leading the senior executive teams.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A former Indiana union leader has been sentenced to 42 months in prison for his role in an assault on a group of non-union iron workers at a church. Jeffrey Veach of Portage pleaded guilty in January to extortion conspiracy and was sentenced Wednesday by U.S. District Court Judge Teresa Springman. Veach admitted that on January 7, 2016, he threatened and attacked non-union workers in a failed attempt to obtain contracts for iron workers Local 395 from two contractors constructing a school at Dyer Baptist Church. Thomas Williamson of Shiraville also pleaded guilty. The 68-year-old Williamson is scheduled to be sentenced by Springman on December 15th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Police are advising the public to be wary of a scam that seeks to mislead and steal sensitive information from Amazon customers in Indiana. The Times reports St. John Police said residents have received messages indicating their accounts have been placed on hold until their billing information can be verified. A link included in the messages leads users to an Amazon lookalike website that is actually a data mining site that actually steals banking information. The message warns that failure to complete a verification process in 3 days will result in the user's access to their account being blocked and all pending orders to be canceled. Police urge customers to not click on any links embedded in a message of this nature and to direct any questions or concerns about their Amazon account directly with the company. For more information or to reach Amazon customer service, you can call 888-280-4331 or visit www.amazon.com/help.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Governor Eric Holcomb announced Wednesday he's lifting almost all of Indiana's COVID-19 restrictions. The state's move to its final reopening phase will have one big caveat. The statewide mask-wearing order will remain in effect. Holcomb says Indiana's COVID numbers are trending in the right direction, but he still urges businesses, bars, restaurants, and individuals to exercise caution even as he lifts capacity limits.
Physical distance between us, if we're around other folks, we've got our mask on, we have different schedules, really creative measures being implemented right now all over the state of Indiana.
There are still a few limitations. Bar customers must be seated, and both bars and restaurants must enforce social distancing. And events with more than 500 people must get approval from the local health department. The final reopening phase and the extended mask-wearing order run through at least mid-October.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana is expanding a small business COVID relief program after it struggled to get many Hoosier businesses to apply. The Small Business Restart Grant Program uses $30 million from the Federal CARES Act, but since June, only sent about $1 million out. That's in part because small businesses who received other federal COVID relief funding were ineligible for the state's grants. New changes to the program removed that barrier. Businesses that accessed federal support, like the Paycheck Protection Program, can also get Restart grants. They must also show monthly losses of at least 40% compared to pre-COVID-19 revenues.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hoosier voters will be able to go to court this fall to ask for polls to stay open longer if there are problems on Election Day. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that's because a federal judge halted an Indiana law that would have barred voters from asking a court to extend polling hours.
A 2019 state law barred anyone from suing on Election Day to keep polls open longer if problems arose, except for a county election board. And even then, the law said those bipartisan boards must vote unanimously to bring the request to a judge. The law also limited a judge from deciding why poll hours should be extended. They could only do so if the polling place failed to open on time or shut down during the day. Advocacy group Common Cause Indiana sued, arguing the measure could make it harder for some Hoosiers to exercise their constitutional right to vote. A federal judge agrees. Judge Richard Young says there are recent examples in Indiana where the 2019 law would have unfairly prevented people from voting, and he writes the state didn't provide any legitimate reason why the law should exist. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The rise of sundown towns came after Black Americans, no longer confined to one county by slavery, began to venture into other areas. White communities throughout the North began to put up signs warning Black people to stay out of their towns after sundown, often with the threat of violence or death. In the second part of this story, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ella Abbott reports on how the impact of those towns continues to affect communities and how it ties into the civil unrest we see today.
James Lowen is a sociologist and historian who authored the book Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. He keeps up a website where he continues to research and confirm suspected sundown towns with help from readers and residents in these towns. Why is it so important to chronicle this part of a town's history? Lowen mentions Ferguson, Missouri as an example of what he calls second-generation sundown town problems. Ferguson was briefly a sundown town between 1940 and 1960. Lowen says the Black population was thrown out by the white population. He says the separation was enforced by an overwhelmingly white police force, which would ticket and harass Black motorists for passing through the town.
Well, by the time Ferguson had the shall we say, riot or demonstrations, for which they are now famous, Ferguson was almost two-thirds Black, but it still had that leftover from the sundown town day police force. So that's an example of a second-generation sundown town problem.
Jacoby Williams is a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Indiana University and specializes in social justice, politics, and civil rights. He explains the relationship policing had to sundown towns during their heyday and how it relates to the distrust of policing we're seeing today.
So, for example, if a person, and this is anecdotal, but these are real-life experiences, a person of color is in a particular location that's classified as a sundown town, and the people of that community attack that person, the police will not arrest them. In fact, they may arrest the person who was attacked.
Today, Williams says this translates as law enforcement who may harass people of color for being in areas they don't think they belong in by following them out of town, searching them without proper explanation, or giving them tickets. He says the civil rights movement in the 1960s and the Black Lives Matter movement we're seeing today are mirror images of each other as they continue to fight for many of the same issues.
The difference between the two periods now is folks are calling for defunding the police, whereas in the earlier generations, in the 60s, for example, and beyond, folks were advocating for community control of policing. So defunding the police and community control is still similar, whereas defunding the police is asking that those resources be allocated to certain entities in the community so the community can police themselves. And in the 60s, having community control of police was the same, having people who are from the community do most of the policing themselves to avoid these confrontations.
Lowen also says that the ongoing legacy of these towns is often misunderstood and damaging. He uses Kenilworth, Illinois, as an example. Lowen says Kenilworth is the richest suburb of Chicago, which 5 years ago didn't have a single black household. After hearing time and again that Kenilworth is just too expensive for black families, Lowen decided to do his own research.
And I found that there are 7,000 black households, black families, in the Chicago area that make more money than the median family does in Kenilworth. So they could not only move into Kenilworth in terms of economics, they could move into the upper half of Kenilworth, into the larger houses. But they don't.
Still, the explanation of just not rich enough not only persists, but is then passed down to younger generations to continue to sow the belief that people of color are economically inferior.
So we have to realize that we're not talking about racism in the distant past. We're talking about racism in a fairly recent past that still affects the fortunes of black folks and white folks today.
As protests took place across the nation at the beginning of the summer, Huntington, Indiana was not immune, even as a mostly white community and former sundown town. Mayor Richard Strick says they saw what was happening in other communities and were able to plan out a response to the protest. He says Huntington's law enforcement community recognized that people coming out to protest had a just cause and are passionate about justice.
We wanted to make sure that we supported them as they exercised their constitutional rights and freedoms and helped them to do so in a way that kept them safe and kept the community at large safe as well, also knowing that there was likely to be, and there was, counter-protesters.
Strick says they were able to set law enforcement up in designated areas, intentionally dressed in casual clothing to make them more approachable to encourage dialogue. Their sheriff and chief of police were able to reach out to organizers and help plan things, as well as supply water. Strick says he believes the protest was a sign of progress for the city because of the number of people who showed up, but also that it means there's still a lot of work to be done. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Ella Abbott.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Legacy Foundation President Carolyn Sexton.
The Legacy Foundation is joining with the Indiana Black Expo as well as with the John S. and James L. Knight Foundations and the cities of East Chicago and Gary, along with the South Shore Neighborhood Development Corporation, to talk about and create a special fund that will help small businesses here in Lake County during the COVID pandemic. And with us to talk about it, we have Carolyn Sexton. She's the president of the Legacy Foundation. And Carolyn, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, Chris, thank you for having me here. I really appreciate it and having the opportunity to talk about this new initiative that we're launching.
Well, first bring up the issues. We know many of them are, of course, all related to the COVID-19 pandemic, but it's drilled home especially to hurt small businesses and, in particular, some of the ones in North Lake County. Tell us about the impact that all of this seems to be having on the businesses in Gary as well as in East Chicago.
Well, you know, communities of color have been hit particularly hard with the pandemic in general. And Gary and East Chicago have had a pretty tough time with experiencing, their residents experiencing the health issues that have resulted from this pandemic. So there's kind of a double whammy, I guess you could say, that, you know, during this pandemic, a lot of the businesses were forced to close because they had, they were given directive from the governor to pretty much do that.
Yeah.
And so they had to lay off some of their staff. And then the residents themselves have had a difficult time in some of the pandemic results where, you know, they've had a higher infection rate. And so it really has created a difficulty for the businesses. So those small businesses, and we're talking those that are have between about 1 and 25 employees that have a commercial space somewhere, you know, in either one of the cities. So they've had to lay off their staff, or they've had to close their doors. And so, as I have said, you know, what we're calling the new normal is really not a normal at all mm-hmm. for these small businesses, and they are hanging by a thread. You know, I've talked to a couple who are doing okay, but they certainly have seen a decrease in the amount of revenue that they've been able to bring in. And, you know, they just want to be able to continue to keep their business doors open. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we have really worked on is how we might be of benefit to those local businesses. One of the things that we did early on is that through our South Shore Neighborhood Corporation, we established a fund to help not-for-profits and small businesses be able to access the PPP loans from the Small Business Association, the mm-hmm. SBA.
Right.
And so we provided those businesses with a small grant to hire an attorney or to hire an accountant or a bookkeeper who could help them with the application, which is a little onerous, I will say. I mean, they said it was easy, but it's onerous, you know, to put together all of that information for those loans. And so as a result, we were able to help businesses. I think we had about 10 or 12 businesses that took advantage of that, and we were able to, through the work that was done in that project, save 300 jobs and access close to $3 million for those businesses from, you know, the local financial institutions here in our region.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought about, okay, what is the next step that we might do to help these small businesses? And so working with some of our partners in Gary, including the Gary Chamber of Commerce and Chuck Hughes there, we were able to make a connection with the Indiana Black Expo and talk about how we might come together and create a fund for small business loans, not loans, grants.
Right.
So these are grants. These are not loans.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Knight Foundation has what we call a donor advised fund with Legacy Foundation. And by the way, Legacy is Lake County's community foundation. We provide grants, we provide scholarships to a number of students here in Lake County, and we provide grants to a large number of not-for-profits who are providing services for our residents. So we had conversation with the Knight Foundation and with the Indiana Black Expo about establishing a fund that would support our local businesses that are struggling during this difficult time.
Now, how did the mayors of Gary and of East Chicago help to get involved in this? They obviously kind of helped channel things along, did they not?
Well, what they have been doing is that they're really promoting this in their communities.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they certainly are very interested in seeing where this goes and how this works for their local business community. We had a get-together where we made this announcement, and although Mayor Copeland wasn't able to come, he had someone from his organization there, and then we had the mayor of Gary, Mayor Prince, who mm-hmm. was able to come and talk about the importance of this program. So, you know, they agree that this is something that is really important. Milton okay. Reed, who represented Mayor Copeland of East Chicago, agreed that with Mayor Prince that this is critical to these small businesses. And they come from different perspectives in some respects, because Milton talked a lot about the fact that they are a Spanish-speaking community with a lot of Latinx business owners, and Mayor Prince talked about the businesses that are owned by owners of color and in that community, and so this is really giving us the opportunity to reach out to these two communities that have had a difficult time during this pandemic, but are trying to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this application opened last week. At this point, we haven't looked at any of the applications. We won't be doing that until we close it later in October. And I think it's the end of the first week in October when we close it. And then we will be making grants between $2,500 to $5,000 to, mm-hmm. to some of those businesses that have submitted their application.
Now,
they do have to meet certain criteria,
I should say,
and that is they do have to have a commercial space. They have to have between 1 and 25 employees. They have to have less revenue than $1 million. So we're talking, you know, really mom-and-pop shops in these communities.
I imagine that probably is going to be a big advantage for them if they are able to get the grants and be able to keep going. They may have had the help from the federal government with the PPPs. That's helped for a while. And we know that even employees are waiting to hear for more help from the federal government if necessary. But this is definitely going to be a big boost, I imagine, for many, many small businesses, in particular in Gary and in East Chicago.
Right. And so we're really excited that we could partner with the Indiana Black Expo and with the Knight Foundation and the fund that they've got here at Legacy to put together a pot of, right now, $50,000. You know, our goal is to encourage others to contribute so that we can continue to grow that that fund so we can continue this program even longer.
Well, Carolyn, you're off to a good start with this particular program with the help of the Indiana Black Expo and the Knight Foundation for all of this to get small businesses in Gary and in East Chicago, if not on their feet, at least keep going. They've had some help, as we mentioned, and they need a bit more help in trying to still deal with the issues from the pandemic. You mentioned some of the application guidelines are, and you mentioned the deadline is coming up for applications in October. How can small businesses in Gary and in East Chicago, and they've gotten all the word from their city officials as well as from the Chambers of Commerce and from Black Expo, how can they be able to turn in the paperwork and be able to possibly receive one of these grants?
So they can go to our website, which is www.legacyfdn.org.
Mm-hmm.
So that's legacyfdn.org. And the application is online. And there is not a lot of extraneous information that needs to be attached with that. We do ask questions about, you know, their revenue, how many employees they have, where they're located, and, you know, just some general information about the organization. We're not directing how this grant is going to be used. You know, I mean, we're not saying you've got to hire an employee or you've got to put this toward, whatever it might be, food if you're a restaurant. What we're doing is saying that this is a grant that's available for you to help your business because we know how difficult it's been for you. So all they need to do is go to our website, and the application is right there.
Well, Carolyn, thank you for all the great information. The best of luck on this, and thanks as well for the Legacy Foundation and for the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation for helping, as along with the Indiana Black Expo, to establish this very special COVID-19 Small Business Relief Fund for businesses in Gary and in East Chicago. And if there are updates, we certainly hope we'll get them from you soon.
Great. Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. Carolyn Saxton is the president of the Legacy Foundation.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.